This episode is brought to you by Revolut, your travel companion for all things money. Revolut lets you spend in over 150 currencies with great exchange rates and doesn't charge for ATM withdrawals wherever you are in the world. You can set up an account in minutes and then instantly add your new card to Apple Pay or Google Wallet. Receive £20 after your first spend when you sign up at revolut.com/Spotify offer until 17th of September 2024. 18 plus. T's and C's apply. Exchange fees and fair usage limits apply.
Hey, it's Charlie. If you like how we break down songs on Switched On Pop, then I think you're also going to really enjoy the podcast One Song, hosted by Diallo Riddle and Luxury. They play the stems of iconic recordings to see how they were made. To give you a taste, today I'm sharing with you an excellent episode of One Song about Blondie's Call Me. And if you dig it, listen to One Song on SiriusXM on Wednesdays, or subscribe to the One Song podcast, which is out Thursdays, wherever you get podcasts. All right, let's get to it. Here's Blondie's Call Me and the podcast One Song.
So, Diallo, today's song was a monster hit. It topped the Billboard Hot 100 for 6 weeks. Damn. It was the biggest selling single in the U.S. in 1980.
Is that true?
It is true. This was the biggest hit of that year, and it was also number one in the U.K. and Canada. But this song's importance can't be quantified in sales alone, because it also brought us Mr. Richard Gere driving down the PCH in a Mercedes-Benz drop-top convertible looking hot.
And it also gave us a mainstream pop song about male sex work.
And it also gave us a genius Italian composer dubbed the godfather of disco. He's also a personal hero of mine. All of this in one song.
Mine too, Luxury.
Yeah.
The song is Call Me by Blondie. The movie it's featured in is American Gigolo. And that genius composer who we'll be discussing at length, in addition to the band, is the one and only Giorgio Moroder.
It's one song, and that song is Call Me by Blondie.
I'm actor, writer, director, and sometimes DJ Diallo Riddle.
And I'm producer, DJ, and songwriter Luxury, a.k.a. the guy who talks about interpolation on TikTok.
But Luxury, let's talk about Call Me. Let's start with Blondie, the band, and the scene that they emerged from.
Right. Well, it's funny because we had an episode a few months ago. We talked about Yeah. We talked about Maps. This feels a little bit like a companion piece because...
Totally.
New York...
It's 20 years earlier.
It's art rock. It's downtown. It's punk rock. It's the convergence of lots of different scenes. And the geography matters. You know, New York has a history of like cross-pollinating different... areas of like, you've got in the 60s, you've got Andy Warhol, and then there's the Velvet Underground, and there's music, and
there's like this
art,
vibrant art scene,
fashion, it's all converging,
right? But it's still New York in the 1980s, so there's still a thriving music scene,
right?
And there are still people trying to find the next Beatles, the next Led Zeppelin,
and specifically in the mid 70s, we have this place called CBGB, which
What does CBGB stand for?
It stands for Country, Bluegrass, and Blues. Once upon a time, it was intended, I guess, to be focusing on those genres. But in the mid-70s, it was just kind of a rundown place in a rundown part
and
of town.
If you lived in New York, it was down on the Bowery.
Yeah.
And
it's on Bowery, literally.
You know, what's funny now is like the Bowery is still like, you know, it's still got a little bit of that New York grime, but not really. Like it, but back then, like this is like crazy Bowery.
Oh yeah, it was a grimy place. It was a little bit sketchy. It was dangerous. Like literally not a place that was safe to necessarily walk around at night by yourself. You know, so the Bowery is the scene, CBGB's is the venue, and you've got a bunch of really famous bands that come out of this scene.
Sure do.
Now, we often kind of overly simplify and call it the punk movement, but really what Blondie exemplifies is how diverse punk was.
Yeah.
So you've got Television, you've got the Dead Boys, you've got Blondie, you've got Talking Heads. All of these bands are formed in this moment in the mid-70s. The Ramones, how could I leave them out?
Yeah. And then I used to always associate the New York Dolls with this, but I think you were telling me earlier, like, it sort of goes to Velvet Underground, and then that segues into the New York Dolls, and we're still sort of based around Max's Kansas City, which is a little bit uptown, and then it kind of like, not uptown, but like it's a little further up on Park Avenue. And then the center of gravity shifts towards CBGB's, which I love this one quote in David Byrne. I think we talked about this on a really early episode of this podcast. But David Byrne said to create a scene, and he was a part of the CBGB scene. He's like, you have to have an area that's cheap enough where artists who just do art, you can afford to live and commute there. And also you have to have a night where the drinks are basically free, so that, you know, because none of these artists have money, right. So they have to be able to come for free, you know, imbibe and then play their
and
music.
They aren't necessarily very like skilled on their instruments, so the alcohol probably helps the sloppiness look feel good and sound good to the audience. That's a great quote, and I love that idea because it really brings us to this moment in New York where it's not New York 20, you know, today. At the time, it's a grimy place, it's a dangerous place, and it's a cheaper place.
Way cheaper.
This is possible for artists of all stripes to kind of like hole up in the warehouse and like try new stuff, maybe not even focusing on what's on the radio or even focusing on getting great at their instruments, but just trying to get out there and make something. And Blondie and all these bands kind of fit. That's one thing that brings them all together, is they're just like, let's make music in front of an audience, no matter what our skill set may or may not be.
You know, hearing you talk, it's actually depressing because it's clear to me that as much time has passed between Blondie and the Yeah Yeahs as Yeah Yeah Yeahs and right now.
Yeah.
So,
damn.
You know,
that's
like
a good point.
So if we went to New York right now, I'm not sure that we could even find like a scene right now, just because it is so expensive to live in New York. I hear people talking about, oh, if you go to Detroit, you know, there are artists in like these abandoned old beautiful homes that were built in like 1906.
Right.
You know, so maybe we all need to move to Detroit. But there's a cultural stew that Blondie, you know, is in.
And, that's right.
How does that group come together?
So another thing that people don't always think about when they think about punk rock and CBGBs as kind of a monolith is that, as Chris Stein from Blondie himself, the co-founder with Debbie Harry.
Oh, Chris Stein, yep.
And original songwriter, the two of them, for the core of the band to this day. Yeah. Chris Stein talks about how CBGBs at the time was sort of had two factions. And I don't know how warring they were versus like friendly, but musically and with their intentions and with their ambitions, there were a group of punks in CBGBs that were more art-focused and more just like, we're going to try to make a noise, get our voice heard, be loud and fast and whatever. Maybe the Dead Boys are more in that category. I think the Ramones might be in the middle. But Blondie themselves were striving to create something that would be on the radio. They were trying to be big. They were swinging for the fences.
Wow.
So it's interesting.
Is Talking Heads a part of that?
You know, he didn't mention them by name, and when he said that quote, I was like, I wonder which camp the Talking Heads are in, because I'm not really sure. I know that they were coming from literally a RISD art school background, so they would technically be in the art rock camp, but like, they seemed ambitious to me too.
They're making pop songs. Even with the lyrics that don't make sense,
right. It
does seem a little bit more like eyes on a larger audience than television, which you get the sense of like, they were just...
They were being experimental. They were trying to do what they hadn't heard. They were trying to put it together, and their songs were longer. They had meandering solos, etc. And the lyrics were not necessarily ambiguous. You wouldn't necessarily understand. Like, the storytelling would be more sort of poetic as opposed to like a narrative. So
I'm glad you bring up storytelling because look, we on the show we talk about art versus commerce.
Yeah,
and I think about like Andrew Bajowski's movies are decidedly less ambitious than some of his contemporaries.
What are some of his movies? I don't know.
I mean, you can look up. He's known as sort of like the founder of mumblecore in movies
Right. Mumblecore.
But like, if you look at Lena Dunham, she's sort of came
like the
from the
Duplass Brothers kind of early
area.
Movies.
Yeah. I guess you could lump that in. I think they had sort of like Talking Heads, like Blondie had like a larger audience in mind.
Yeah.
As opposed to some who just make the movies and it's entirely just for themselves to stay in that sort of like art corner.
And to be clear, I don't think it's necessarily only one thing. I think that all artists, all creators probably have a little bit of both. They want to tell their story. They want an audience. They want to be heard. They're always balancing that a little bit with like, what's something new and innovative I haven't seen before, but I'm also going to mix it with, say, a story structure that has been used successfully time and time again with like, you know, your inciting incident is on page 10 of the script, you know, that kind of stuff. So you're always balancing a little bit, being innovative, but also being like...
Which rules do you
commercial.
Break? Yeah.
Yeah, which rules do you break? Perfectly put. So Blondie is not just bringing in their different commercial ambitions. Like, if you listen to early Blondie records, you'll hear 60s-sounding girl group sounds. Mm. You'll hear, I mean, it's a little bit later, but they do a Rocksteady cover. They do The Tide Is High, which is a reggae Rocksteady song. And, of course, they do Heart of Glass, which is disco. They do Atomic. They're trying a lot of different styles musically, but they're also deep into like the art world as well. So they're friends with Basquiat, who shows up in the Rapture video. He's playing the DJ. It's not Fab Five Freddy. It's Basquiat in that video.
That's crazy too.
Yeah,
I love that. And Rammell Z was in that group. Shout out to Brett King. I know that he listens to the podcast.
Nice one.
He was on that scene and some of the pictures that come out of that scene.
I wish that I was part of that scene. So
that is the one place where you just get the sense, was everybody effortlessly cool?
So like, cool. So cool. And there's like a Geiger, H.R. Geiger, who did Alien.
Yeah.
There's a Blondie video where his stuff is in the background. background, or sorry, he directed the video. And in the background, you see a canvas, which is all Basquiat. So they're like swimming in these incredible, like famous artists all these years later.
So you could say that the inspirations for everybody from James Cameron to Jay-Z are all a part of this New York scene.
Blondie was doing all, was picking apart all of it, yeah. And not unimportantly, Wild Style. So like hip-hop, we're going to get into the hip-hop stuff in a minute, because Blondie in 1977 tells a story how they went up to the Bronx with Fab Five Freddy for this police athletic league party, and that's where they're exposed to hip hop.
It's called the police athletic league?
Yeah, yeah, yeah. It's the cops try to get all the kids off the street and do something where they can watch them.
Those pictures of the Bronx when it just looks like rubble.
Yeah,
is
totally. It's like a
to
bombed
me.
Out. Well, Wild Style, we love this movie. Let's talk a little bit about Wild Style, because this.
Well, I mean, Wild
Style
is one of my personal favorites. If you ever get a chance, you should definitely just, you know, find it, watch it. Blondie, by way of Chris, was involved in Wild Style. It's a great movie. It encapsulates a special time in New York, and I would argue two
hip-hop
special
history,
times
yeah.
of hip hop history. Because here's a composition by Chris Stein. It goes by a couple of names. You sometimes see it as South Bronx Subway Rap, sometimes it's South Bronx Theme. But this is from the Wild Style soundtrack. And that came into my life. I didn't even know that song at the time. It really came into my life. It's played in the background of the opening of Nas's opus Illmatic. Check this out.
Hey yo, yo, pull out and shave, man. Let's count this money, nigga. Hey yo, Nas, put the jacks, put the grass over there, you know what I'm saying? Cause we've been in the Jacksons. You know how we get down, baby.
Yeah, I mean, like, Chris Stein playing on possibly the greatest hip-hop album of the 90s by way of a sample.
And between that and Rapture and the Fab Five Freddy and the Grandmaster Flash, the bona fides of Blondie being part of multiple scenes at once.
Of hip-hop,
they're punk,
yeah.
they're disco, they're hip-hop, they're everything at once. And the Chris Stein participation in the soundtrack, he was a crucial part of it. He's on every track. It's it's funny because, like, those beats are so sick. And it's by this drummer, Lenny Ferraro.
By the way, his drums are wonky. Can you tell us
There's
that real quick?
Cool story behind that, because the whole thing starts with Lenny Ferraro playing drums to nothing. The concept was, it's DJ Grand Wizard Theodore took his favorite breaks and he gave them to the drummer. This is, by the way, Fab Five Freddy is the person behind the soundtrack. Mm-hmm. So he brings together Lenny Ferraro on drums, David Harper on bass, and then Chris on guitar and effects. And
he brings
everything
in Kaz
else.
To do a lot of rapping.
But step one is DJ Grand Wizard Theodore pulling together his favorite breaks, giving them to this drummer, Lenny Ferraro, and saying, vibe off of this for 2 minutes.
Wow.
Just play whatever you want. So he's playing to nothing. There's no song.
Damn.
He's just playing 2 minute loops like a human drum machine. Basically.
Oh, that's insane.
He's
didn't even know that.
He's playing like a human pause tape, basically, with those breaks, right? And then David Harper plays bass with those sick bass lines. And then Chris comes in and does that final layer on top with the synths.
It's so
and the
dope.
Guitar.
If you haven't seen it, please rent Wild Style and report back to us.
So another thing about Blondie's eclectic taste is that they genuinely loved, they adored, in fact, disco. They even covered Donna Summer's, like, one of Diallo and my collective favorite songs of all time. They covered I Feel Love by Donna Summer. And that at CBGB's in the late 70s would definitely have turned a lot of heads.
But it's important to talk about timeline here. So we talked about the New York Dolls. They're more like 74, 75, but there's already a sort of nascent disco that's out there.
Right.
So I'm thinking specifically of the song Rock Your Baby, 1974 by George McRae. You can hear the coming of disco. So that's proto-disco right there,
yeah.
George McRae, Rock Your Baby.
I mean, and it's so funny because, like, hearing that, I'd totally forgotten that it starts out not just with a drum machine, but with a drum machine with the same exact, like, samba preset with
yeah.
the clave.
Is that the, is that the limb?
I don't know what George McRae is using, but mm-hmm. Blondie in the song I'm about to play you is using a Roland CR78. And listen, it's the exact same, not just the fact that it is a drum machine, but it's the da, 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 the clave, 3-2 clave for all you Afro-Cuban percussion nerds
out
there.
Don't get racist.
No, it's called Afro-Cuban percussion.
No, I'm playing. Three under the bus on that one. It's rock your baby sped up.
It's rock crazy. Your baby sped up. I never noticed that connection. That's cool.
Heart of Glass, obviously.
Yeah.
The first time they record Heart of Glass, this is one of my favorite Blondie songs, actually. It was called the disco song. So George McRae came out in 74. This song comes out in 1975. So, and to be clear, that was never released. Yeah. That is just a demo that us Blondie fans.
Yeah, it's an early version, a demo.
Yeah, it's a very early version of the song.
Which then evolved into the disco banger we all know and love to this day.
Absolutely.
Yeah. And one more thing I want to add, I did find a cover, so let's play it. I did find Blondie playing I Feel Love, so. I'll play a little snippet.
The first thing you said when you started playing is like, oh, they use guitars.
Well, we're going to talk about sequencers a little bit later because how do you make 16th notes happen in the 70s? Well, it's an early technology to make da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da.
Yeah.
On guitar, you can do it by going by using your thumb.
It's hard, though. It's super hard.
It's easier on guitar than it is
really
with a synthesizer to get the perfection.
Oh,
but
okay, yeah. The perfection, yeah.
The synthesizer, you can kind of go da-da-da-da-da-da on the same note. But to actually have it sound robotic and Kraftwerk-like, which was...
Oh,
motoric Kraftwerk with technical precision.
Nancy's one Kraftwerk concert. He comes back with Kraftwerk.
This is Kraftwerk, is the name of the band, okay? Say it properly. It's challenging, but it's starting to happen. And I'll talk more about
that. We're
going to
talk about it, but can I just say, this is the first time
neither of
us have ever heard it.
Yeah.
The funny thing about this is that it sounds like country music. When Giorgio does it, it sounds sleek and it sounds like the future. There's something about those guitars.
Yeah.
Where it sounds like you should be like
it needs to be it needs the precision.
Don't say it. You know, it's like
it matters. Like to play a 16th note bass line or the guitar part version of the bass line, it's definitely not the same vibe as the Giorgio version.
And
which is okay for a cover.
But you know, I'm drawing connections that may not be there.
Okay,
but we know that the Italians did those spaghetti westerns,
right?
And maybe when he was using his sequencer. Because I think Giorgio's a genius. We're going to talk about our fandom. Maybe he was like trying to accomplish something that sounded kind of American, kind of Western with the sequencer. And then because it was created on the instrument that it was, it created a future sound that is completely removed vibe-wise from American country music.
That's an interesting
theory. We'd have to ask him. Thankfully, at the time of this recording, he's still alive, so maybe we'll reach out to him. He still lives here in L.A.
I think he does live in L.A.
Yeah, I think he lives right up there in the hills, right about, because I used to work at the Standard, and I used to see pictures of his house.
I was just going to say, I have this one picture from 1981 with the models. I'm hoping that's where he still lives.
I'm hoping he still lives there.
Blondie covering I Feel Love is such a pleasure, such a joy to hear, and I love the fact that they were doing it. I found a quote from Debbie Harry, who said, "We used to do Heart of Glass to upset people, because the rock crowd thinks we sold out and the disco crowd thinks we're punks." So you really can't please anybody in 1979 by covering that song. Everyone's going to like walk out.
Meanwhile, the hip-hop crowd's like, they better never come for this.
But they love disco. They love Marauder. They do the other song they do is Atomic around the same period of time, which is a straight-up disco song, which I love.
You know, it's so fast. I sometimes don't think of Atomic as a disco song, but you're totally right. It's probably up there with like the Sylvester, You Make Me Feel... tempo, probably, right?
I forgot how much I love that song, and it is so disco, unabashedly. They're swinging for the fences of the disco crowd with that one.
I like to think that song was playing at the premiere party for Flash Gordon.
Oh, I would love to have been at that party. If you and I had been co-DJs.
If I had been the DJ, I'd be dead.
We would have been fighting over who gets to hit play on that one because we would have both loved it so much.
But Heart of Glass, Atomic, Tide is High. This is a group that's not afraid.
Not afraid.
pin a pin or cover a great pop song.
Yeah, within the context of the CBGB, you know, art rock and punk rock crowd.
Yeah,
brave. These are brave people.
And by the way, we have to mention the band's important connection to hip-hop.
Hell yeah.
Because I believe Rapture is the first charting song by a white rapper, aka Debbie Harry. So that she gets that distinction.
She does, and it's one of the first raps a lot of people heard, myself included. I think I would have heard that on the radio, probably. I might have heard Rapper's Delight. I don't remember. But like they were both within a year of each other.
Yeah.
Both big hits, and that was definitely the first rap that I fully memorized. Cars, guitars, eating bars.
Fast Woo! Five Freddy said that everybody's fly.
Yeah. DJ Spin and I said, my mind flashes fast, flashes cool. That's Grandmaster Flash and Fab Five Freddy both get shout outs.
Absolutely.
There.
You can tell they were absolutely part of that scene. You know, this is my first exposure to Blondie as well. I definitely loved, you know, as a kid who listened to the radio. So I you know, I heard those Bee Gees songs. I heard Blondie. You know, like I didn't have control of the radio yet. So I don't know which parent of mine I was riding with that they were listening to this stuff. But, you know, in my very, very earliest childhood memories, I remember liking, you know, Blondie. I remember thinking that they sounded different and cool. And they're a group that I came back to really, really appreciate even more in my 20s. Like, if you had asked me around the time I was, like, 25, like, what is your favorite rock group of all time? I would have probably said Blondie.
Wow, really?
And yeah, because I liked all the different places they could go.
Right.
Like, already my... by 25, I had sort of shifted away from being a all hip hop DJ to more of an open format DJ.
Okay,
and so I was spinning house and drum and bass and all these other things, and I was like, what rock band has had influence in all these different genres? Like I couldn't really think of one except for Blondie. Seemed like they had almost like an open format approach to music.
That's a great way to put it, and I totally agree.
It was like whatever they thought was cool or happening. Talking Heads was a little bit like that. Like I think that it's actually Tom Tom Club, which you know you guys know that's the rhythm section of Talking Heads.
It's Chris and Tina,
right? But it's sort of that same thing. It's like Blondie was like, "What's the music by other artists that we like? Oh, we'll dabble in that art form."
Yeah,
and then they went off and did that genre.
But they have probably before them both the Beatles and Bowie as influences, among others. But those two as like every album and every song within a single album trying a different form, a different style,
different,
right? That idea, like by contrast, no shade on the Rolling Stones or the Ramones, but there's, you know, a lot of bands or AC/DC, right?
They're like, we do one thing.
Other end of the spectrum, it's like every AC/DC album, a little bit sounds the same, let's face it, which is not shade because if you like AC/DC, you probably want to buy a bunch of records.
I always felt like Run DMC was like, we found our look in 1983.
Right.
And it's only when they tried to go different around like 1990 and they loved Down with the King, great Run DMC song. But when you mention Run DMC, there's always sort of like a classic period and they're forever in that period.
Yeah.
But yes, Blondie was not afraid to dabble. And also when I was in my 20s, I should point out, they were still releasing songs. Like Blondie did a song called Good Boys, which I thought was a good song. And the Maria? Scissor Sisters, who I believe you know, they did a remix that was really cool. So Blondie had a way of staying relevant and current, even, you know.
They're still touring to this day. They're still going strong. And
yeah,
we
they
love
just
that
did Coachella not too long ago.
Yep, and I saw them a few years ago. They're still incredible live. Clem Burke on drums is still like a powerhouse at 70, whatever.
Are you serious?
Yeah.
He still plays the
He's great.
So we've talked a lot already about like how much we love Blondie, how diverse their songwriting and song crafting is. You know, it was like some of their album cuts, you know, that really won me over. So as much as I like the songs that we've all sort of heard over the years, one of my favorite was the song called Live It Up.
Walking bass line. We love that.
Yeah, so that one is called Live It Up off of Auto American. But let's talk about Call Me, because Call Me is different from other Blondie songs because it's not purely the band who created it. It's a mix of the band, some session musicians, and importantly, Giorgio Moroder. Before we tell the story of the song, we're huge Moroder fans. We are. Tell me how you came to love Moroder.
I'm happy to do that. So we've mentioned this man a few times already on this episode.
He's
the king of disco. He's an Italian man living in Munich and making some of the greatest hits of the 70s. Most famously, a lot of the stuff he did with Donna Summer. We mentioned I Feel Love. iconic, possibly the greatest song ever recorded, ever put to tape.
And don't forget Love to Love You Baby,
love
which
that song.
I think that song is so epic. And I love the story how it gets made. So apparently, you know, the song is already sort of a modest success in Europe. And then Giorgio Moroder brings it to Neil Bogart at Casablanca Records here in L.A. Used to be right up there on Sunset, right across, once again, from the Standard Hotel. That building's gone now.
Okay.
They have like a giant camel in the lobby. I wish it was still there. And basically, he was like, please put this out. Every other American label has passed on because it's just too long. And Neil sort of, you know, he sort of goes in the other direction. He's like, you know, I'd like to have a song that's even longer. You know, because when we're doing a lot of drugs at our parties, we want
no one wants to go to the turntable.
Yeah. We want to put on something that can last for about 20 minutes.
There's no CD changers yet or Spotify playlists
exactly.
yet. Yeah,
there was no autoplay. Right. So Neil's asked for a version that's like 20 minutes long, and Giorgio gives it to him. But this is literally Donna Summer's first single.
Yeah,
and her first hit in America. Right. Yeah, it goes to number 2 on the Hot 100. And
it's an entire album side. It's 16 minutes, 49 seconds, album version.
It's
crazy.
Amazing.
Yeah.
Here's a snippet for those who've been living under a rock for the last 40 years.
When you're laying so close to me, there's no place I'd rather you be than with me. Yeah. Oh.
Like, Neil heard that, and he was like, hey, it sounds great. Give me 19 more minutes. These are 1975 decisions when you have an office on the Sunset Strip.
But a lot of blow.
but that is, you know, that is Giorgio's first foray into, you know, this American market
and
the disco
era. And hit-making, and Donna Summer and her. The two of them together have this incredible career together, hit after hit after hit.
And then he has some that, you can't think about Midnight Express without thinking about The Chase.
Well, that's a perfect segue into the answer to your question, which is this is the first time I ever heard Giorgio Moroder. It wasn't because of the movie, which, by the way, when I was a kid, I did see some of on TV.
And it haunted
me for life.
From your brain.
Oh, my God. Do not see Midnight Express.
No, don't let your kids watch Midnight Express.
Weak stomach, my God. But I think the first time I heard, I think it was like a bumper for the Olympics or something.
What?
And I heard the music sort of, you know, come in a little flash of 20 seconds. I had never heard anything like it in my life. And so here's the song that changed my life. And it took a long time for me as a musician to like absorb. It was something that I wanted to make for like decades until I finally became a musician. But here's what I heard. Little Luxury. That song.
Yeah, I mean, I love Moroder so much, too. I definitely have a love of what I call his galloping bass.
Yeah.
You know, like, and I feel like it just created a whole genre. We've talked on the show about how Bowie and others just felt like, oh, I've heard the future of music.
That's right. Brian Eno came, when he heard I Feel Love, he ran, apparently, maybe to Bowie, and said, I've just heard the future.
Yeah.
And he wasn't wrong, because you can really trace the history of all modern electronic music between Kraftwerk and Moroder.
Yeah.
To this day, it all sounds modern and contemporary.
Bambata,
it doesn't sound old.
Too. Yeah.
But as far as like floor to the floor,
totally.
Like house and dance and techno, like so many fraction versions of house music and dance music, it begins with...
This is the birth of something
it's
new.
It's the birth of something new.
After the break, more pummeling Moroder sounds and galloping bass, triplet shuffles, and American Gigolos. Don't you dare go anywhere.
Don't do it. Stay right here.
Hey, Sue Bird here.
I'm Megan Rapinoe.
Women's sports are reaching new heights these days, and there's so much to talk about. So Megan and I are launching a podcast where we're going to deep dive into all things sports, and then some. We're calling it A Touch More. Because women's sports is everything. Pop culture, economics, politics, you name it. And there's no better folks than us to talk about what happens on the court or on the field and everywhere else, too. And we'll have a whole bunch of friends on the show to help us break things down. We're talking athletes, actors, comedians, maybe even our moms.
That'd be a fun episode.
Whether it's breaking down the biggest games or discussing the latest headlines, we'll be bringing a touch more insight into the world of sports and beyond. Follow A Touch More wherever you get your podcasts. New episodes drop every Wednesday.
The Walt Disney Company is a sprawling business. It's got movie studios, theme parks, cable networks, a streaming service. It's a lot. So it can be hard to find just the right person to lead it all.
When you have a leader with the singularly creative mind and leadership that Walt Disney had, it like goes away and disappears, I mean, you can expect what will happen.
The problem is, Disney CEOs have trouble letting go. After 15 years, Bob Iger finally handed off the reins in 2020. His retirement did not last long.
He now has a big black mark on his legacy because after pushing back his retirement over and over again, when he finally did choose a successor, it didn't go well for anybody involved.
And of course, now there's a sort of a bake-off going on. Everybody watching, who could it be? I don't think there's anyone where it's like the obvious no-brainer. That's not the case.
I'm Joe Adalian. Vulture and the Vox Media Podcast Network present Land of the Giants, The Disney Dilemma. Follow wherever you listen to hear new episodes every Wednesday.
All right, welcome back to One Song. Luxury, walk us through it. Tell us how this song got made.
The story begins, my friend, in Munich.
Mm-hmm. Marauder in Munich.
Marauder in Music, making music at Musicland. That is the name of his studio. Beautiful. And it's important to start there because the song takes life originally as an instrumental that Giorgio Moroder produces and puts together with his crack team of engineers and right-hand men.
So he didn't create it for Blondie. He just created a song.
The song was created for the movie, but we didn't have an artist yet for whom it was intended.
Uh-huh.
And there were some original lyrics, by the way, which we'll get to a little bit later, which were a little bit different. And importantly, there's a second individual who's a big part of this story, and his name is Harold Faltermeyer. He is Moroder's right-hand man. You may recognize the name.
I do, but please continue.
Well, many people, 80s kids, may remember that name if for no other reason than for this song, which was a big hit in the 80s. When he went solo a little later, the song is called Axel F.
Yep. Can I just say real quick about Faltermeyer and Moroder? In a way, I'm jealous because I feel like they were working with new instruments and everything that they played felt like the future. You know what I mean? Like, they're just playing notes.
You're right, because no one had heard these sounds before. You're right.
It doesn't sound like 1972. It sounds like we're making music in the moment. And just the other day, I was thinking, like, what do we have now that feels like, no matter what the output, feels like the future? This might be a hot take, but it might be AI. And the only reason I say that is because if somebody, you know, like King Wallonius or some of these other people who are putting out, you know, AI songs, when I see what is clearly the AI cover art, because it sort of has a look.
Uncanny Valley. It doesn't look, it's Uncanny Valley. It's not quite, it's so hyper real that it's unreal. It's,
you can kind of tell. There's a part of me that's like, don't reject this outright. Because, you know, you don't want to be that guy in 1982's like, I just want to listen to the blues. Like, you know, in a weird way, I'm almost like, maybe we just got to embrace the technology.
Well,
I don't know.
I think that you're onto something. I would say that the sound of right now that is in like, that is definitely new and is technologically driven. And in a few years will sound like this time now because it will be sort of preserved in amber because we'll have moved on in a way. So then we can refer to it is the artifacts of AI. I would say it's when AI is trying to do a genre and it's a little bit off.
And it's off.
And you can tell
that the mistakes sort of like...
It's like, you know, Ariana Grande doing a Dolly Parton song and the mixture of those two things based on what they've trained the AI on has these weird artifacts that sound like you're underwater. Do you know what I mean? Like what I'm talking
about?
Totally. That's very now. That's very AI now.
I agree. And I by the way, that was my point, but I do want to also play devil's advocate and say...
Okay.
The problem with AI is that it's just copying what came before, whereas Faltermeyer's keyboard on there sounds like something we had not previously heard. So all I guess I'm saying is that if we can invent some new sounds, I'd be all for it. But let's get back to Call Me. You were telling us about the actual recording of the song.
Well, Mr. Faltermeyer, whose Axel F would be a hit a few years later, at the time he was Moroder's right-hand man. He actually came on board around the time that that song Chase that I played for you was being put together. He also co-wrote Hot Stuff with Donna Summer. And he's one of the implementers, I would say, of Moroder's grander vision. Here's a quote I found from an interview in 2014. This is Harold Faltermeyer talking about Mr. Moroder. He says, Giorgio is a genius, one of the most gifted writers in pop music ever. I'm going to emphasize that word. Mm-hmm. Not the greatest player. He was a composer. And when he played you demos, he would play a chord on the left hand and a chord on the right. In other words, he wasn't like a technically proficient instrumentalist. And he would say, Harold, you have a look. I have this new song. And Harold would go, okay, interesting. In other words, Faltermeyer was a bit of the translator from a more big picture idea to the specifics of how do we make this an actual produced and recorded song. Harold Faltermeyer, in other words, was kind of the person who helped Moroder implement his ideas. And that's important because on this song, as we're going to talk about in a minute, a lot of the specifics of what you hear sonically, to your point, that sort of in 1980 would have been new and exciting sounding, is coming from Faltermeyer's technical and instrumental abilities to execute Moroder's vision. Again, to be fair, it's the two of them together. It's that collaboration.
I love that.
Getting back to the song, which becomes Call Me, it starts life as an instrumental, which was recorded in L.A., and they originally offered it, I don't know if you know this, do you know what they originally offered it to? Call Me was supposed to be for Stevie Nicks.
Oh, I could totally see that.
This was meant to be because Stevie Nicks was the huge star. Sure. I mean, Blondie was an up-and-coming star, too. Yeah. A little bit different world. Stevie Nicks was like mainstream pop radio superstar.
It almost goes Stevie Nicks, Blondie, Debbie Harry, Madonna.
Yeah,
you know what I mean.
Yeah, in terms of chronology,
like a quick succession of like she's the vocalist you want.
Right, exactly. Yeah. She's the A-list.
Yeah,
she was unable to do it because her contract with her record label wouldn't let it. It wasn't that she turned it down because she didn't like it. She just literally wasn't able to do it. So they threw it to Blondie, and here's where the story gets interesting because Blondie is a band, five people, punk rock band from New York. But the bandiness starts to get complicated when Moroder and Faltermeyer come into the picture. Mm-hmm. That's not how they're used to making music. They're used to having complete control. They're using electronics. They're putting together tracks. They're not necessarily playing with instruments and the temperament of different band members in a band dynamic. So when it comes
like the first time Maroon 5 came in and Adam Levine was like, hey, I got the song finished.
Yeah.
They're like, we're Maroon 5, dude.
No, it's really just me and you guys are hired guns who will play what I tell you to play. It's a little bit of the it can be the dynamic sometimes. That can be a tricky thing.
It can.
And in this case, when Moroder brings this track to the band, they all insisted that they would play their own parts. Apparently, Chris Stein's guitar and the amplifier were buzzing and noisy, and so they were trying to get a clean recording, but it was difficult. They had a difficult time locking to sync. Remember, these are like this original track is coming off of this sort of perfect precision coming from the sequencer, and the band is just not used to it. They're used to a human drummer, Clem Burke, playing the drums, having a little leeway with how the tempo's going. It's a lot of trouble, and as Moroder later explained to Billboard, his experience working with recording the song is what led him to never work with a band ever again. He said, quote unquote, there were always fights. I was supposed to do an album with them. After that, we went to the studio. The guitarist was fighting with a keyboard player. I called their manager and quit. It was just
That's so complicated. It reminds me of James Murphy working with The Rapture on House of Jealous Lovers and having it goes so south that he was just like, I'm not going to work with Rapture.
I've heard that. That's really interesting to hear that. And there is some power that the producer has once all the things are recorded.
Yeah.
And they can start making choices about what to use and what not to use. And that's a perfect segue into the stems because I am not 100% certain of who the performances are on every track. There's some Rashomon, especially, for example, about the drums who actually played. We may never know because there's also like the desire to not hurt anybody's ego.
Mm-hmm.
You want the band to think they're on it. They may or may not be on it. So essentially the five members of Blondie play through all their parts. Debbie Harry sings, Jimmy Destri on keyboards, Frank Infante on guitars. They all play their parts and then they're sort of dismissed from the process. And then Moroder and Faltermeyer take the master tapes back themselves. They get their studio musicians to replace some of the parts and make decisions about what's keepable and what needs to be replaced. And we'll talk about that at a micro level when we listen to the stems in a minute. But once you get the recordings in, you can decide what to do with them.
Yeah, and if you have the session musicians, you don't have to deal with all those opinions that you don't necessarily
They will do
deal
what
with.
You tell them to do. Yeah. They will not even take a cut of the publishing. A lot of advantages to having those session musicians in on this song.
All right, we have stems. Luxury, where do you want to start?
Well, I'm going to start with the drums. And so here's where we have a little Rashomon. So Harold Faltermeyer, in that same interview I referenced earlier, it's a 2014 Red Bull interview, he mentions that the drums are being played by Keith Forsey, who's a session drummer. He's on a lot of the big Donna Summer hits. He also later played for Billy Idol. But then later on in an interview I heard with Chris Stein, he mentions that it's Clem Burke on drums. I'm not sure who's playing drums. I think it might be Keith Forsey, but it might be Clem Burke. Either way, they're amazing.
Yep.
And let's listen to them isolated. These are the drums from Call Me.
Sounds like glam drum. Sounds like glam rock to me.
You're hearing the triplet 6/8 feel, and this whole song has that feel, which gives it a little bit of a bump, ba bump, ba bump, ba bump, because
but
that's
it's also
literally
that flourish of the bum 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 bum. Like that's not a modest don don.
No, that don. That's what makes the song a Blondie Moroder collaboration, because that's Chris Stein with those rock and roll guitars. But I want to talk a little bit more just for a minute before we move on about this shuffle beat. Now, this is a fast song. It's 142 BPM. That shuffle beat with the triplets, da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da. A shuffle beat means you're hearing the da-da-da-da-da-da in the other instruments, but on the drums, you're just getting da-da-da-da-da-da-da, which is basically like a swing, like a jazz da-da-da-da, and you just leave out the second of the three triplets.
Totally.
And that's how you get the shuffle beat. And you've heard it in a lot of other songs. I'm going to play for you a little fun medley I made of a bunch of pop songs that use that beat and its alternative version, which is a halftime version called the Purdy Shuffle.
That's funny, because when you said 142, I'm thinking 71.
Yep. Well, you're going to hear 71 and 142 right now.
All
right. Here's a little medley I put together. Here are some other songs with that same shuffle beat.
I thought I was the DJ. That's not fair. That's not fair. Okay,
I had too much fun with that. I started getting into that. I was like, no,
come in here with a full drum set, one man band set up, and
we got Fleetwood Mac.
No, that was fun.
We got the Blondie. We got the Fleetwood Mac. We got "Fool in the Rain" by Led Zeppelin, which is the Purdy Shuffle. So it's halftime.
Sure. Tears for Fears.
We had Tears for Fears. What else I put in there? Oh, Higher Ground by Stevie Wonder.
Yeah, the Stevie meshed real nice.
Yeah, right.
There's like I'm such a DJ purist. I'm like, some of these are way slowed down. Some of these are. Yeah. Little sped up.
I had
but
to cheat
some of
a little
them were
bit.
Like right in the pocket.
I had to cheat
like,
a little
great.
Bit. Yeah. And then we ended with a couple more Purdy shuffles in halftime with Rosanna by Toto. And the final one was Babylon Sisters by Steely Dan.
That's great.
So those are all examples of the shuffle beat. I'll play a little more of the isolated drums. And this is the verse pattern. I love these open hi-hats, how it creates kind of a riff with the open hi-hats.
That's super cool.
So cool, right? And then here's another chunk I like because it's got a lot of fun fills in it. So everyone knows where we are. Well, let's move on to the bass. As I mentioned before, since this was the process involved, starting with the track, adding Blondie and then apparently removing a fair amount of Blondie from the mix, I actually could not find a credit anywhere, not on Discogs, not on Wikipedia, not anywhere about who is playing the bass here. It might be Nigel Harrison from Blondie. It might not be. It might be Chris Stein himself doubling it. But let's listen.
I mean, already a good enough song in my book.
Yeah, you could just stop right there.
Already sounds cool and, like, sneaky.
Ooh, sneaky is a good word. What makes you think it's sneaky sounding?
Like, I don't know, man. It just sounds like, you know, I'm walking down Vermont Avenue in freaking Los Feliz, and there might be somebody following me.
It's very cinematic, yeah.
So I dip into the alley by Pinky. Shout out to Pinky's no longer there.
Oh, we're so sad that Pinky's was fun. We're going to find our new place.
For our little shindigs.
For our shindigs.
But so that's what the bass line is doing.
Yeah.
But you know, when you were playing, it occurred to me how much I love the keyboards on this song.
Well, guess what you're going to get next?
Keyboards!
Let's hear them. So we know that this is definitely Harold Faltermeyer and definitely not Jimmy Destri, the Blondie keyboard player, because in all of the interviews I've seen, there was some tension behind the recording of this part, but also the technical nature of how to create this. And I'll play it for you in a second. You'll hear what I mean. But these are the Marauder / Faltermeyer 16th notes that are sequenced to perfection. And it requires a certain amount of technical skill to do it. Now, Blondie had done this before. They had done with Heart of Glass, different producer with Mike Chapman. They had figured out how to do that da-da-da-da-da-da-da thing. But in this case...
It's a slower tempo, though.
It's a slower tempo, right. And in this case, Faltermeyer and Marauder just took out the Blondie performance and redid it themselves, including, importantly, the solo.
Yeah, you know, I like that.
Yeah, you know, I like that. You know, we both. Like
I mean, that sounds like
I could just listen to that.
That
all
sounds
day.
Like some Tron stuff. That sounds like the lost soundtrack to Tron.
I could just listen to that sound over and over again. I just want that. And you hear a little bit of organ in there. There's a bunch of synths in the mix there. There's the main There's the main rhythmic one that's sequenced, and then you've got an organ in the background. There's a second version of that sequenced synth line, which is not 16th notes, it's 8th notes, and I'll play that for you now. In the mix, you can't really tell it's happening, but it adds a little bounce. I'll play it for you isolated first. And that gives you more of that swing, that shuffle and swing feel, right?
Almost sounds like a march.
It's very, I was thinking the
it
same
almost
thing.
Almost sounds like a march.
It's got some, it's a little Teutonic sounding. It sounds very German. And now I'll play both of those sequence synths together. That second one is very subtle, but now that you've heard it, I mean, here's... I can hear how it adds a little bit of
Absolutely.
Bounce to it.
Yeah.
And let's add back the drums just for sheer pleasure's sake. That's like perfect music. You can't do better than that. You can't do better than that. Why try? Okay, so this is back to that modulation part, the bridge, the ooh. This is fun to listen to because you can hear, I never noticed it in the mix until I listened to the stems, but that organ is doubling the melody. So that's this part here.
There are so many lyrics to this song I did not realize I didn't know.
Yeah, me too.
I filled in the blank on a lot
the
of these lyrics.
First verse
I didn't even realize she was speaking Italian in one part and French another.
Italian. The whole first, I mean, I must have sung out loud and karaoke and otherwise the first part of this song a million times. And it wasn't until preparing for this episode that I finally figured out what those lyrics were. But we will get to that
we will
in just
talk
a
about
moment.
It just a moment.
Just a moment. First, we have a little more synthy goodness before we get to the guitars and then Debbie. So here's the synth solo, which Harold Faltermeyer performed, not Jimmy Destri from the band Blondie. And he very noticeably, if you ever watch footage of them playing the song, Jimmy Destri does not play this part. He was not happy about it. He felt like his solo was better, but he lost the battle to what stays on the recording.
Uh-huh.
And here is that synth solo. One of my favorite parts is towards the end, there's this sort of insistent D that keeps on, that's kind of like, I think it's called an inverted pedal, where it's just the same note. You'll hear that in the mix here. This is towards the end of the song.
It's one of my favorite parts of the song.
Yeah, and it adds... It adds a sense of
That's
urgency.
That's one of my favorite parts of the song.
Yeah.
It adds a tension
it's a
there.
Tension,
like,
exactly the right
it's like
word.
A ding, ding, ding.
It's staying the same while everything else is changing.
I like
it. Yeah. I call that the insistent D in my notes. Just if anyone wants to start using that.
That might be my new DJ name, insistent D.
I don't think it should be for reasons that we don't need to get into.
I think you're wrong.
All right, now let's get into the guitars. This is Chris Stein, and it's not second guitarist Frank Infanti. He, too, was booted off the final recording. There was the issue that they had when they were recording that there was a lot of noise, and they couldn't quite find... It took all day, apparently, to record these guitars because they couldn't really find the source of the noise. And every now and then, you can kind of hear it when he stops playing for a moment. But these guitars are so great, and they're huge. They're panned left and right for this giant sound. And as we talked about before, that combined with the synths really make this a very modern-sounding clash of punk and disco, and Euro disco in particular, that stands the test of time 40 plus years later. Chris Stein on guitar, Isolated Guitars for Call Me.
I mean, That's rock god stuff.
That's rock
right?
god stuff right there. He loved playing that. He had a good time playing that part, yeah. Here he is in the chorus. So good, right?
Wild.
So fun. So
love
wild.
It.
It's wild when you hear it isolated. It kind of reminds me when we listen to the Prince stems, right? Sometimes, I mean, we knew that there's big rock guitars in here, but the fact that they're balanced out with the synths in such a way that, like, neither is too heavy,
mm-hmm.
like, it comes across as a pop song with rock and disco leanings, I suppose, or maybe synth pop. Like, what the way to classify the song, not that it really matters, but, like, what even genre? Is this a rock song? Is this, like, a dance song?
It's kind of a disco song. It's disco rock.
It's a disco rock.
But it's also like super sped up and fast.
Yeah, it's so fast for the dance floor, right? You can't, it's really hard to find 142 BPM songs to play before and after.
Totally.
Yeah. And this is the anytime, anyplace, anywhere part. And I'll bring that in so you can hear it in context. Because I love that high guitar thing. I can't get to that note. I can't do it. I can't find that note. Oh, I want to play that again because that's one of my favorite parts. That is such a rock god. Like, it's you gearing up to hit the solo. Like, no. That's like some heavy metal. Like that's not
absolutely.
A punk rock choice, that one.
You know, one of my favorite things on any song, I always love hearing the vocals with nothing on them. But I will say this, when the song gets released, Blondie is only accredited the vocals, which is wild to me. But let's talk about the vocals
let's
now.
Let's talk about them.
We know Debbie Harry has one of the most iconic voices ever. She wrote these lyrics, and she wrote them after watching a little bit of the movie, and she said that she loved the shot of him driving up the coast of California.
Yeah, that's what the movie begins
with.
Yeah,
and she was, and she writes these lyrics, which, you know, again, I don't know that I knew the lyrics to Call Me. I know what I was singing. If you put a gun to my head and you said, please don't put a gun to my head. But if you
let's
did,
just start right there.
But if you did, and you played verse one and you said, what are the lyrics to the first verse? I would have been like, call on me.
That's what I thought.
Come on, baby.
That is what
call
I thought.
On me. Oh, call. Which
I
doesn't make sense.
The same thing.
Oh, call does not make sense. But
feel comforted by the fact that I made the same mistake
I think a lot
all these
of us
decades.
Made that.
Yeah.
The lyrics are literally color me your color, baby. Color me your car.
Mm-hmm.
Color me your color, darling. I know who you are. Come up off your color chart.
Color chart. So poetic.
I know where you are coming from.
Yeah.
So that's news to me. Now, when she gets to the chorus, she does say, call me on the line. And all that, but like, you know, there's a lot more going on here lyrically than I think that we knew.
Yeah, Debbie says that she had the color palette of the movie made an impression on her, and that's why the song starts with.
It is strikingly.
Yeah,
can we hear a little bit of verse one just so we can know that the audience can know that we're not making this up?
Color me your color, baby. Color me your car. Color me your color, darling. I know who you are.
I mean, that's super cool. There's another part, a lyric that I don't know that I even had a substitution for.
Okay.
But now that I know the lyrics, I kind of want to hear it in the mix. This is in the second verse where she says, now I did hear roll me in designer sheets, I'll never get enough.
Right.
But then she has this next line that I want to talk about on the other side. Can you just play me that?
Roll me in designer sheets, I'll never get enough. Emotions come, I don't know why. Cover.
Ooh.
I don't know why cover up love's alibi.
Yeah, that's a great, that's very poetic.
I love that.
Yeah, that's not your typical pop
song. I mean,
song.
If I'm trying to break that down, I think she's saying like, why hide what we feel? But yeah. Like, it's a little bit, what do you think cover up love's alibi is
I'm
about?
Only assuming from the movie, because she watched the movie, that it's got something to do with the plot line of the movie, right? Because you've got Richard Gere and he needs to have an alibi for the crime.
Yes, that's right. There's some murder involved.
Yeah.
Yeah, I was just thinking about it in the context of the song, but you're right, that might literally come directly from the movie. Like we said, in the bridge, she speaks English, French, and Italian. I probably just thought it was gibberish, but maybe we can hear a little bit of the O Amore.
Okay, there's another word that for all these years...
Chiamami.
It means...
I probably thought she said, like, chamomile or something.
Like, call me in Italian, literally.
Oh, no, yeah, now we know.
But chiamami. Like, I never would have guessed that until
I
finally took the moment and looked at the lyrics. And then she moves into French.
Ooh, appelle-moi mon chéri, appelle-moi.
Appelle-moi, mon chéri, appelle-moi. There's the punk rock attitude, right? A little snotty, appelle-moi.
Absolutely. I mean,
call me.
We didn't really mention it, but Debbie, you know, at one point she had been a Playboy bunny at the Playboy Club in Chicago.
Yeah.
She moves to New York while the band is still trying to find their identity, their name. You know, this is old New York, so the construction workers are, nowadays it would absolutely be harassment, as it should be.
Right.
But they used to call out to her, hey, Blondie, hey, Blondie. And that is why the band was called Blondie.
That's how they got their name.
You know, there are people who confuse her name for being Blondie. No, Blondie's the name of the band.
Yeah, she even tells the story that early on she tried to convince the rest of the band to also bleach their hair blonde. Just for that reason, she was like, hey, I'm thinking about all of
like
us.
That.
And nobody wanted to do it. She was like, at the time, it would have been unusual, too. She's like, it would have been, as she puts it, what wrestlers do. So they would have all looked like a band filled with wrestlers.
It's so funny you bring up wrestling because, you know, from the Teutonic march to the... soaring, you know, keyboards, like there is something extremely and almost goofily dramatic about this song that did make me think. I can totally see, like, in an earlier era, wrestlers coming out to like this, these guitars and that,
with the guitars, especially. Yeah,
and you know, ultimately, these lyrics. Those are some great vocals.
I wanted to also just go back and play some of the really beautiful harmonies in that second verse.
Harmonies achieved by doubling up Debbie.
So this is Debbie going back and singing harmony to herself, exactly.
Okay.
Cover me with kisses, baby. Cover me with love.
And I'll just play the second part of that isolated so you can hear that harmony. It's really beautiful on its own.
Roll me in designer sheets, I'll never get enough.
Ooh, I love it. That is some minor sugary greatness.
Roll me in designer sheets, I'll never get enough.
Such a beautiful blend, right?
Yeah, that's really nice.
I just noted some background noise, too. They are recording in New York, presumably at a studio, but that sounded
reminds
like,
me of one of my
like she was
favorite...
in her like apartment with the window open.
It reminds me of one of my favorite moments of hip-hop in the last 12 years.
I got to close the window before I record because New York don't know how to be quiet.
There you go.
I mean,
that's definitely real. Yeah.
Is the opening of ASAP Ferg's Work remix.
You got to keep those ad-libs. That gets a little
Absolutely.
Character in there. And here are just some fun little ad-libs towards the end. You can hear these isolated.
Call me anytime. Call me. Oh, call me. Mm-hmm. Call me. In my life. Call me. Call me anytime. Call me.
And I always love, because we have access to the stems, we can hear what was recorded, but either wasn't used because it's an outtake, or maybe in this case
muted
it's
it. Yep.
Muted it, or in this case it's the fade out. So here's, once when you listen to the song and it fades out,
fade out, yeah.
This is what happened right after the song ended. In my life, the sweet delight line.
Yeah,
I think,
you're
part.
Right. I never heard that. Yeah. Wow. Her voice, she can get up there, man.
Yeah, she's a belter.
She's way out there.
It's such
like,
a great,
way high.
And the quality of it, too. It's got power. It's got emotion. And it's high. And it's strong.
There's something, I was going to say, there's something like cat-like about it that I can't quite put my finger
feline.
On.
Feline. She's very feline.
There's something felinic.
Slinky.
Is that a word?
She's slinky like a feline.
Can't figure it out. But, man, it still gets you.
Oh, and let's not forget one more thing.
Okay.
We do have the call and response part. Let's listen
call
to that.
Me.
Yeah, exactly.
Call me.
Let's hear another one of those.
It's just one guy. I always thought it was like a chorus of dudes, but it sounds like one guy
call
with reverb.
Me.
It sounds like a couple guys.
You sure?
We'll get one more in there. Let's listen.
Call me.
It's either one guy doubled. Could
I
be
think
Chris.
It's the same guy doubled.
One more.
Call me.
And I wonder, is there a little German accent there? I maybe detected.
I think you've been listening to too much Kraftwerk.
It could be too much Kraftwerk is making me think everybody German.
Those are some great vocals. Ultimately, these lyrics, you know, like we said at the very beginning, they're about sex work. Like,
yeah.
Technically, the fact that this is such a huge pop hit
right.
Is almost just hilarious to me.
Yeah.
I want to play something that points out just how big a hit this was. Remember, this song is about technically a male sex worker. Here's one of the places that Blondie performed the song.
Well, here we are at the finale, and I bet you know what that means.
Debbie Harry!
That's right, Debbie Harry!
Yeah!
The visual
right.
of Animal
Kermit
playing
the Frog,
that drum
yeah.
kit at the beginning is hilarious. Let's talk about some covers, samples, and interpolations.
Let's do it. Let's talk samples, interpolations, covers, the whole world of musical reuse. There's another episode where maybe their biggest sort of sample, I think, in the world is probably the one
that, by Missy Elliott.
Exactly. Yeah. We have an entire episode about that. Go definitely check that episode out with our good friend Punky from SNL. Yeah. Let's move into one of the songs that not everyone knows is a cover, but The Tide is High by Blondie from 1980, which sounds a little bit like this. Such a brilliant song. Yeah. Not everyone knows that this is a cover, but it is, in fact, a cover of the 1967 track The Tide is High by the Paragons.
No, the tide is high, but I'm holding on. I'm gonna be your number one. Number
yeah, very cool. Just straight up cover.
Straight up cover. Like
it harkens back to the time when like a movie would be popular in Japan.
Yeah.
And they never thought, oh, why don't we just release it here? No, we have to remake it.
Right.
Because... Yeah, you know, that's the only way people will accept it.
And just like in my own personal experience, a lot of people may not have ever known the original.
Yeah,
not
no,
have heard
I think
the original,
a lot of people don't know that's a cover.
Which serves the purpose of turning them on to the original when they discover it years later and falling in love with it, like everyone listening to the show just did. It's The Paragons, 1967. Go check it out.
That's really cool. In addition to that, we were just talking about Work It by Missy Elliott. There's another very famous female rapper that has sampled Blondie.
Yes, there is. And this one's for all you barbs out there.
Gannett. But I should have done him first. I stole his heart and then I put it in a verse. He caught feelings when I wrote it in reverse.
Couple things I like about that. One is that it's reharmonized. Like there's just different chords behind it, which transforms it, besides obviously the vibe of the instrumentation.
Is it a sample or is it an interpolation?
Well, that was the other thing. Like I'm definitely hearing that it's an interpolation. There would be no reason to sample it. However, here's the thing. In the modern day, you can have something like a vocal resung and save half the cost of the effort to reuse it.
Totally, yeah.
If it were a sample, if it were just the a cappella like I have in my stems, if it were that sampled, you'd essentially pay twice as much to use it. Here's the thing. I actually am friends with Vaughn Oliver, who I spoke to recently, and he cleared this to be discussed, but he's the guy who co-produced and co-wrote some other stuff for Nicki, such as Super Freaky Girl. Hey, girl. He told me the story of that song, and they originally were going to interpolate the Rick James stuff.
Sure.
But Nicki apparently insisted on keeping the original. She wanted Rick James on the track.
Uh-huh.
So, which is really interesting because there's an authenticity to keeping the original,
yeah.
but it's an expensive authenticity.
Yeah. But I think at this point, she's got the money to be like, you know what? My musical vision first.
Yeah, if you and I were doing this track, we'd probably be like, I'm singing this. I'm not even hiring anybody. We're interpolating the heck out of this and replaying it. But with Nicki, my guess is it's an interpolation. It's probably replayed, but it might not be because she didn't do it with Rick James, so maybe she didn't do it with Blondie. Another icon, right? Interesting thing.
Absolutely,
about.
Another icon. Okay, so like we said earlier, Call Me was written for the movie American Gigolo. I used to love that movie. I know you watched it recently.
Yeah.
Does it hold up?
Let me just put it this way. I watched the first half recently.
Oh, no, you didn't even finish it.
I got the gist.
Oh, man, okay? Come on.
It's one to look at. It's such a joy to see Los Angeles in 1980, the visuals. It's so sexily shot. Every frame is a picture.
Totally.
We've got the Giorgio Armani suits. By the way, I only learned in researching this episode that this is that Giorgio Armani's bursting onto the scene as a popular...
With this movie.
Came from this movie.
Yeah,
it was
totally.
Sort of a lesser-known Italian designer.
I'll say...
and I could not get past the 59-minute mark.
So it's got Giorgio Moroder, it's got Armani, it's got all the Giorgios.
Yeah, all the Giorgios.
What's funny to me is that when I first saw this movie, probably for the first time, it was like mid-2000s, maybe like 2007 or somewhere in there. And that opening had a huge effect on me. Like, you know, I saw him driving up the coast and I was just like, I want to do that.
Oh, you were living in New York at the time?
I was living in LA. I hadn't moved to New York yet. And I saw him driving up PCH and I was like, you know what? I'm going to find a convertible and like do that one time in my life. And I ended up...
That's why you bought your convertible?
That's how I ended up with that convertible.
That's an influential
scene. But, you know,
scene.
It's by the way, we're supposed to be talking about Call Me. I have to say, one of my favorite things as a screenwriter is thinking about the first song that you will hear over the first image of anything I write. So usually
it
in my scripts,
the,
I'll put
tone,
in, like,
right?
you know, music plays, and I'll put the name of a thing. Because it's so important. Like, I think about A Hard Day's Night, you know, by the Beatles. I think about Trainspotting with Lust for Life, like that running in the beginning. I always say, if you can start a movie with running, it's such a solid way to start a film. I mean, actually, now that I think about it, Faltermeyer, you played Axel F. earlier.
Yep.
Beverly Hills Cop, The Heat is On. Like that first shot of Detroit, and it's like, The Heat is On. I'm like, I am into this movie.
No. The trucks
did it
guys
so well. Yeah, like you see industrial stuff, and it's like, you know, how are they going to tie Beverly Hills into this?
It's exciting,
The 80s were really good for that. I think about Back to the Future, The Power of Love, now on Broadway, Huey Lewis in the News. Like, that was big. Fight the Power by Public Enemy and Do the Right Thing. Like, there's so many movies where, I mean, obviously Saturday Night Fever with, you know.
Right, that opening sequence, walking down the
street. Staying Alive, yeah.
Strutting down the street.
To the disco beat.
In the Bronx, probably, right? Yeah.
We talked about Midnight Express, The Chase. I'm even thinking about Shaft. I mean, Shaft, people say, is the transition song from sort of like the music of the 60s into the 70s of soul and disco. You
know,
theme from Shaft.
I like
that. So I just think that there's nothing more important than that opening shot and that music. You just tie it so much to your experience with that movie. So Call Me is 44 years old at the time of this recording. What is its legacy, Luxury?
Right.
What does it say about art punk versus commercial punk and just art versus commerce in general?
Well, I think that that's still a question that musicians today, myself included, are constantly having to face. You make decisions at a micro and macro level, like, is the song I'm working on, should we try and do something that's on the radio now? Should we aim for now? That's never a good idea, by the way. Or should I just sort of go into my more obscure lyrics section of my journal? You're always trying to balance things out, and like, you want people to hear it and love it, but you also want it to be true and authentic and you individual to you as the artist. Blondie was working with that and did such an incredible job of balancing all of the things that were them as people, that were their interests, disco, hip-hop, art, culture, uptown, downtown, the Bronx, Manhattan, like it all, works in the mix in their music, and then specifically with this song and all their hits of that era, what strikes me is how like listenable they still are. Like there's, I suppose you could say, a datedness to it, because you can tell, especially with the Marauder thing, that was definitely the thing of 1979, 1980. Sure. But it doesn't feel dated to me in a way where it's like, you know, like a big reverby snare and a metal song in the mid 80s and a hair metal song. That sounds dated. Like, you wouldn't do that now unless you really wanted to evoke Motley Crue or Poison, you know, one of those bands. So this stuff really holds up sonically to me as a band. And the artistic decisions required to survive as a musician remain to this day.
Yeah, I like that. And I like the idea of artistic decisions, because you mentioned, you know, being true and being authentic. Mm-hmm. I think, look, American Gigolo is a mainstream movie about an underground thing. Mm-hmm. You know, something that is, you know, underground and just by its nature niche. And I think similarly, this song is a commercial approach to something that was still at that point underground,
yeah,
which is disco and punk.
Yeah.
So I think both of these pieces of art, which are forever sort of joined, are by their very nature sort of the merging of art and commerce, sort of taking something that's niche and underground and figuring out how do we expose it to a larger audience.
And by the way, they sort of dodged a bullet in the sense of like disco demolition happening right in this time. And this song, had it maybe not been for the guitars or Blondie's reputation, you know, a lot of bands like Nile Rodgers frequently talks about how like Chic and his career starts to decline in terms of their opportunities.
I would argue that you've opened up a Pandora's box, because there was a level of racism with the disco demolition.
Yeah, of course.
And
there
I
was.
Do think that yes, they had guitars. I would argue that Chic had guitars. Chic was just using them for R&B, maybe a little bit more than rock. I think at the end of the day that on the one hand, Blondie is moving forward. As we said, whatever is sort of popular, they're figuring out their take on it.
Yeah.
But I also think at the end of the day, they're seen as a white group, so it's easy for them to make the transition. It was a lot easier for a lot of those fans that were destroying records at Comiskey Park to sort of reject the groups, the ethnic groups.
I want to just yes and, because I think just to build on that, I think you're absolutely right.
Yeah.
And I also think that part of the choice to use distorted guitars is a coding as a choice that moves you out of the category to me of disco and funk. Yes, there are distorted guitars sometimes, but Nile Rodgers in particular, because you mentioned him, is famously, he's got a really clean sound. And that tiny distinction, I mean, you're talking about adding distortion to guitar or not, and the parts, it actually does make a difference, as does the face of the person on the cover.
Yeah, because there's some other groups that didn't use distorted guitars that also made the transition.
There
from
are.
That disco era into rock. And again, it's, and also, like, disco did not actually die.
Of
like,
course, yeah.
You know, you can argue that in those America, Michael Jackson albums that took over the world just a year or two later are essentially the same kind of disco music. It's still got Quincy Jones at the key, at the boards.
Just brought him to the mainstream.
That's almost a topic for another time.
And one more thing, by the way, because you mentioned Nile Rodgers, an interesting thing, I've heard him talk about how he was influenced by Marauder, those 16th notes we talked about before during this episode many times.
Yeah.
Nile Rodgers was
State of Independence.
Trying to emulate the sound he heard Marauder doing with those 16th notes. And part of his sound is that he is an almost impossibly talented human right wrist finding those 16th notes in a way that in Germany they needed devices to perfect. Yeah. And Nile Rodgers is an incredible songwriter and many things, but also he is an incredible guitar player, because those 16th notes on his guitar, on the Hitmaker as he calls it, that sounds like it could be coming out of Marauder's Musicland Studios in Munich, which is what he was aiming for.
Absolutely.
And if you made it this far, I think it means you like the podcast. So please don't forget to give us the 5 stars on the platform you listen, leave a review, and please, this is maybe the most important thing, share it with your friends, with your family, with someone you think that would like the show, because it really helps keep it going.
That's right. Luxury, help me end this thing.
I'm producer, DJ, songwriter, and musicologist Luxury.
And I'm actor, writer, director, and sometimes DJ Diallo Rip.
And this is One Song. We'll see you next time.
This episode was produced by Matthew Nelson and Chris Neary, with engineering from Marcus Hom. Additional production support from Casey Simonson. The show is executive produced by Kevin Hart, Mike Stein, Brian Smiley, Eric Eddings, Eric Weil, and Leslie Guam.